Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, second hour of Internet Open Forum with our guest, Jimmy Akin, who is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and a whole bunch of other things, including The Bible is a Catholic Book. And he's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which is, scores. I don't want to say the number, but scores of episodes on mysteries of secular kinds of mysteries, mysteries of historical significance, scientific mysteries, mysteries of the faith. It's just a fun exploration of this mysterious world around
going
us.
Going on 200 now.
Going on 200 episodes.
We just recorded like 173 this weekend.
Wow.
We recorded a couple this weekend, 169 and 173. That's what they were.
You skipped some then.
Well, yeah, we don't always produce them in order.
I never went back and looked, but was your 13th episode on fear of the number 13 or anything like that?
No.
Come on, man.
Not on Triskaidekaphobia.
You have to get to 666 episodes, though. You cannot stop until you get to six.
We'll probably do Nero before then.
Oh, okay. But. All right. Well, Internet Open Forum works like this. Questions come to us via the internet. We get them all gathered up together here.
That would be like 12 years, a decade or so from now.
Well, that'd be good.
Because we produce 53 a year.
Well, you'll be doing it as a hologram at that point. I don't know what the technology will be for podcasting.
Just 10 years.
10 years, but stuff moves. I'm not saying you will be a hologram, you, Jimmy Akin. I'm just saying the technology for broadcasting will be some kind of hologram. Mm. You don't think so?
Not in 10 years.
No? Oh, all right.
That's a known phenomenon in futurism. There is a tendency among futurists to overestimate how quickly inventions will arrive in the short run, but to underestimate where the technology will go in the long run.
Yeah. Well, I just can see Jimmy Akin as like Princess Leia, getting, mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about?
Help me, Psychillate, you're my only hope.
Yeah, you're my only hope. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, technically that's not a hologram. That's a volumetric display.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So what's a hologram then?
Hologram is an image that appears to be three-dimensional, but is like printed on a two-dimensional surface, like those things on credit cards.
Oh.
Those are holograms.
Oh, I got to start saying that other thing then. What'd you say?
Volumetric display.
Volumetric display.
Because it displays the images as in a volume of space.
Yeah. It used to bother me when I would see that.
I really personally don't stress about the distinction because everyone calls them holograms.
But when I would see that in Star Wars, it used to bother me because I thought it doesn't seem possible that you could be the light could be coming from one direction and produce a three-dimensional. And I'm sure there probably is some way to do it, but I could never.
We do have volumetric displays. They are they're primitive, but we do have them.
All right.
In the future, with programmable matter, whatever.
We're going to have to talk about programmable matter sometime then.
Yeah.
Yeah, that will be interesting. Let's go to Jad's question to start off the questions this hour. If God knows everything, why does he allow a soul to be born when he knows that soul will choose hell?
Yeah, this comes up a lot. And to deal with that, I wrote a blog post on the subject, which we should be able to have a link to in the show notes. It's called, Why Would God Create People He Knows Will Go to Hell? And it's at jimmyakin.com. And I've listened to a lot of people try to answer this question. And as I point out in the blog post, they tend to do one or both of two things. The first thing they often do is they will talk around the question and never answer it. They'll just say, they'll start talking about free will and stuff. And they never, I know people have free will, but why would God do this?
Yeah.
And they frequently end up not answering that. They just talk around it. Yeah. Or if they do answer it, they'll say, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Well, okay, it's true, it's a mystery. But I think we can be a little more informative than that.
Okay.
So in my blog post, I talk about the different reasons that one might propose for why God would do this. The first is that he does it because there is some competing good that he is protecting. That, God, according to the Catechism, does not allow an evil to occur unless he's got a good he's going to bring out of it. And so in these cases, there would be some good that he is he is bringing out of this. Now, that good might be free will. It might be his glory. Those are the two things that are commonly proposed here, but it could be something else. Another answer is to say, well, God is always just, so even though he does this, he's not being unjust. And that's true, and that's helpful to point out, but it's also not really an answer for why he would do this. Another thing that you can propose is that if God creates someone he knows is going to go to hell, he's actually benefiting that person. That it's actually better to create someone who is going to be in a suboptimal condition, but it's better to exist than not exist. And hell would actually be better than non-existence. And so in this situation, it would be like, well, why is God going to create someone if he knows that they're not going to use their free will correctly on every occasion, and they're not going to end up at the highest spot in heaven?
Well,
it's still better for them to exist and be in heaven, even if they're not at the highest spot. And the same thing, some people propose, could be true of hell. It's better to be real. There are still good things that happen in hell. Every created being has goods. And so so there are still goods, but it could be better to be in that condition than to not exist at all. Just like it can be, you know, even when you're depressed or frustrated in this life, you can say, okay, it's better to be alive than not, even though I'm kind of frustrated and depressed right now. Maybe that's what hell is like. Another possibility, maybe he doesn't. This would be the hope suggested by theologians like Hans Urs von Balthasar, that even though if someone did reject God, ultimately they would go to hell, maybe God doesn't create anybody who actually does that. And so everybody ends up in heaven. That would be consistent with his view. And then there's the one that I tend to favor, which is to say that the starting assumption is wrong in this, there's a scenario being proposed where God knows what the person will freely choose if he doesn't create them. Now, there's a fancy philosophical term for that that's called a free will counterfactual. It's free will because the person freely chooses to reject God, but it's counterfactual because it never actually happens on this scenario that God could see, oh, if I create Bob, he's going to reject me, so I just won't create him.
Yeah.
Okay, that it's counter to fact if God doesn't create Bob.
Right.
This presupposes a view that God has knowledge of what would happen by free will choices that are never made.
Right.
And this is a view sometimes called middle knowledge by philosophers. And middle knowledge was proposed by a Jesuit named Luis de Molina, and it is an influential theory of how God's knowledge works, but it is not the only theory. It is not, for example, the theory of Thomas Aquinas. According to Thomas Aquinas and other theologians of his era, God knows all possible things, and God knows because he can envision them all. I mean, he can think of every possibility there is. So God knows all possible things, and God knows all actual things. And so he has those two types of knowledge. But knowing the outcome of a free will decision that is never made would not be something that God knows on Thomas Aquinas's view. And I tend to favor that because if it's really a free will decision, then there's nothing that determines its outcome except the making of the choice.
Yeah.
Because God's not forcing him to do it, and circumstances are not forcing him to do it. So there's no way to tell the outcome of a free will choice except if the choice is made. And so so free will choices that are the outcome of a free will choice that is never made, or knowing the outcome of a free will choice that is never made, sounds to me like knowing the shape of a four-sided triangle.
Yeah.
It seems to involve a logical contradiction. And thus, it would not run afoul of God's omnipotence, because God, just like God can't do things that involve a contradiction in terms, God can't know things that involve a contradiction in terms. Like, God doesn't know the shape of a four-sided triangle, because that's just word salad. It's not a real thing that could exist. And in the same way, the outcome of a free will choice that's never made and knowing about it seems to fall into that category for me. So I would say that the solution I tend to favor is God creates people and then at the same time simultaneously sees the choices they make in their life.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see an easy way for him to know what they would do if he had by free will, yeah. if he had not created them.
Right. It's a great question, Jad. Thank you very, very much for it. It's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Time for us to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum right after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. So happy to be here with Jimmy Akin for 2 hours just answering questions on that come to us via the internet. We do open forum all the time. As a matter of fact, almost every Tuesday and Thursday, we're doing an open forum, and you're always welcome to call the show at those times. But the questions that come via the internet, we don't generally get to them during the live episodes, so take some time to do that now. This next one comes from Taylor. And Taylor asks this, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the parable of the vine and the branches, assuming that as adopted children, creatures adopted by the Creator, we are branches grafted onto the vine and not naturally growing from the vine, mm-hmm. from what other vine did we come?
So Taylor's thinking of two passages in Scripture. One is John 15, where Jesus tells the parable of the true vine. The other is Romans 11. Where Paul tells the parable of the olive tree. And he's really thinking of Romans 11, where Paul talks about Israel as a cultivated olive tree that Jewish people are conceived of as branches of. And then Gentile Christians are grafted onto the tree of Israel from a wild olive tree. And so that it's really olive branches that St. Paul is thinking of here rather than vine branches. But the answer is, well, Israel has a special relationship with God. Of all the peoples in the world, God chose Israel as his own people, and he has a special relationship with them. He's helped them grow. He's helped correct them. He's helped them develop. And so they are, in this metaphor, a cultivated olive tree. One that God has specially tended to and personally cultivated as a people. Other peoples are also created by God, but he didn't have the same relationship with mm-hmm. them. And so in the metaphor, they're wild olive trees. They're not cultivated by God the way Israel was. And so the metaphor of a wild olive tree here just means a people that was not in the special relationship with God that Israel was. Whether you conceive of the others, a grove of wild olive trees or just a single wild olive tree, really goes beyond the metaphor. You could look at it more than one way. You could say, okay, the Gentiles collectively are one wild olive tree, or maybe they're a bunch of wild olive trees. Maybe there's a Greek wild olive tree for the Greek people, and a Roman wild olive tree for the Roman people, and an Elamite wild olive tree for the Elamite people. But that really goes, it's interesting to think about, but it really goes beyond the metaphor. The metaphor is concerned with Israel, which is God's special people. And now, as a result of Jesus Christ, God has been taking people from other nations that he did not tend the same way he tended Israel, and he's making them part of Israel as part of spiritual Israel.
Taylor, thank you very, very much for that question. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's an internet open forum, and there are just so many questions. We'll just keep rolling through them. This one comes from Jad. Could you provide some insight if there are verses in the Old Testament that should make clear that Jesus is the promised Messiah? What are the Jews missing?
So Christians, it can be very easy to look at various Old Testament passages like, behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, you know, from Isaiah, and say, ah, okay, virgin birth, that's Jesus.
Yeah.
But we need to learn a key lesson, which is that you need to read every prophecy in its own historical context first, before you start trying to apply it to other things. And this is a key example of that. If you read the passage in Isaiah in its original context, the reason the virgin or young woman, the Hebrew word is Alma, it can mean both. The reason that the young woman is going to give birth and bear a son is to give a sign to a king that lived in the 800s BC. And in fact, we're told in that passage that before the child has gotten old enough to know to accept the good and refuse the evil, that the enemies of this king will no longer be threats. So we've got a short window of time, because this is not like some prophecy that's open-ended. It can be fulfilled thousands of years from now. It's got to be fulfilled in his own day. His enemies are not going to be threats anymore, and that's going to happen before some child is old enough to say, ooh, that's bad, I don't want that.
Yeah.
And so we're dealing with a period of a few years at most from the date the prophecy is given. And so some child was born in this time frame. It could have been the son of the king. Some people have speculated maybe it's a son of Isaiah the prophet, but it's some child here in this time frame. But the text has a secondary application to mm-hmm. Jesus. Now, it so happens when you read a lot of messianic prophecy, there's a fulfillment in its original historical context, but in this broader spiritual sense, it applies to Jesus. But it's only in hindsight you can do that. If you take the literal interpretation of the text, it's not about Jesus, it's about something nearer to when the prophet wrote. There are some prophecies that speak more directly of a future Messiah, but they also contain less information about him.
Yeah.
And that means it's harder to identify. So really the case for Jesus as the Messiah based on Old Testament prophecy is a cumulative case that gets made from a few texts that speak in the literal sense of a future Messiah, and a much larger number of texts that in the spiritual sense foreshadow the future Messiah. But precisely because this is it's not in the literal sense, if you're not coming from a Christian perspective, it's easier to miss that.
Yeah.
And so as a result, it is possible for someone in good faith not to pick up on all this. You know, there are other ways of understanding these texts. Like someone could say, oh, this one from Isaiah, it's about a kid that was born in the 800s BC. How does that prove it's Jesus?
Yeah, right.
Well, it doesn't prove it. You have to be willing to say, okay, there's a secondary spiritual sense to this text that we can now view in light of what happened. And if someone doesn't buy that principle of reading the text, then they're not gonna buy the argument. So there is a document that the Pontifical Biblical Commission put out back in 2002 called The Jewish People and Their Sacred Scriptures in the Christian Bible. And it's on the Vatican website. You can look it up, The Jewish People and Their Sacred Scriptures in the Christian Bible. And even though the Pontifical Biblical Commission is not an organ of the magisterium, it's a theological body that's run by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And at the time, its head, the Pontifical Biblical Commission's head, was Joseph Ratzinger. So this is a perfectly orthodox document. But it goes through, in part of this document, it goes through how you can read the Old Testament texts in these different ways.
Right.
And they don't exclude each other, but we also shouldn't just blame Jewish people for, like, how can you be so blind?
Yeah.
Because it requires, it's not like the text forces you to this conclusion. It requires, as St. Paul says, you know, spiritual discernment that's a gift of the Holy Spirit to pick up on some of this.
Yeah.
Also, in terms of why Jewish people in his own day and subsequently as well have not recognized Jesus as the Messiah, many of them, of course, there are many Jewish Christians, but the ones that haven't and that do believe in a Messiah is in part because the dominant expectation was a political Messiah.
Right.
And Jesus made it clear that's not what he's here to do. My kingdom is not of this age.
Right. Okay, well, Jad, thank you very, very much for that question. You know, as you were speaking, Jimmy, I was thinking about Jesus with the disciples on the road to Emmaus, that he had to explain to them.
Yeah.
You know, like, this doesn't just pop out at you. He had to explain to them. Here's the references to me.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got time for another here before I have to take a break. Marino, how do I explain to a relative the seal of confession can't be broken even if it brings justice to others who have been hurt by someone?
Okay, so let's consider this principle, the idea that the seal of confession should be broken when it would bring justice to people. Okay, so suppose you stole a dollar from work and you went to confession, and even though that's a venial sin in most circumstances, you confessed you stole a dollar from work. Would you want your priest going to your boss at work and saying, this employee just stole a dollar from you?
I would not, definitely not.
Yeah, well, it would bring justice though, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, right.
Yeah, so we can all sense how, even though breaking the seal would help bring justice in various cases, we don't actually want that to happen.
No.
And so there's no, in principle, bright line where you could say, okay, so if it gets this bad, that's when it's okay to break
it. $50 he should tell her.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And so we recognize that there is a good being done in confession that outweighs the injustice that is allowed to happen if we don't break the seal. And this is, in principle, something that's accepted in other fields as well. And this could also help your friend understand this. We acknowledge the same principle in legal courts, because you have to prove someone guilty in a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, what about cases where we can't prove it beyond any reasonable doubt? What if the evidence just probably points to this person doing it, but it doesn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? You could say, well, justice isn't being done if we let this guy go because we couldn't prove it to that degree. But that's something we're willing to accept. If we're going to lock someone up in prison, we really want to make sure that person is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And the good we're protecting in that case is not locking innocent people up just because the evidence doesn't seem in their favor. Because you can make anybody look bad with a slick lawyer. So we really want proof before we lock someone up. And that's, in general, even without the beyond a reasonable doubt, that's behind the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. And when our founding fathers wrote that into the law, they acknowledged, because we're presuming someone innocent until it's proven that they're guilty, we're going to let some guilty people walk free. But that's better than reversing it and saying guilty until proven innocent and requiring innocent people to prove they're innocent. which is much harder. So as a society, we're willing to live with some guilty people going free in order to protect a greater good. So what goods are the seal of confession protecting? Well, one of them is the privacy of the sinner. And number two, which is actually the more important one, is it facilitates that sinner's reconciliation with God and thus his salvation. And his salvation is more important than anything that might happen in this life, including a judicial procedure. It's more important that that soul avoids hell and spends all eternity with God than anything that might happen of him going to prison for life or whatever it might, or some lesser sentence, whatever that might be. And so the church has deemed, like society has deemed, that it's better to let some guilty people be free of criminal consequences in order to protect these greater goods.
Hey, Marino, thank you very, very much for that question. I know it's become a pressing question in some places around the world where there's pressure on Catholic priests to share, even legal requirements.
Also, people would just never go to confession if they knew their priest was going to rat on them.
Yeah, no. No, I don't want people finding about that dollar that I took. All right, Marino, thanks. More Internet Open Forum right after this with Jimmy Akin. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an internet open forum. Just reading ahead a little bit and lots of great questions coming up. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And it's worked just like a regular open forum. It's just that we're not taking the questions via phone. We took the questions from the internet. The next one comes from Jim, who asks, is a confession still valid if you just drank some alcohol? I'm talking like one or two drinks when you're not drunk but may feel buzzed.
So the answer is that being buzzed when you go to confession will not invalidate it. In order for it to become invalid, you would have to be so incapacitated that you are no longer capable of performing a fully human act. And if you're only buzzed, you are capable of performing a fully human act, and thus the decision to go to confession would be something that you were doing as a moral agent, and you would not affect the validity Now, a more interesting question is, what if you were so blitzed you didn't even know you were doing it? I mean, you forget it later. Yeah. Suppose you're so blitzed and you don't have a prior decision. Because if you have a prior decision before you get drunk, I'm going to go to confession.
Right.
Then you would be already have made a determination of the will.
Yeah.
When you were still in control of your faculty. So it would be valid. But let's suppose you get drunk, you're totally out of it, you decide, I'm going to go to confession, and you do.
You just see a priest at the cocktail party, and you're like, Father, I love you.
And somehow the priest hears your confession, you get through it, even though you're totally blitzed. Would it be valid? That's the more interesting question. And I think there's an argument that it would be, because the sacraments work as long as you're not putting a barrier between you and God. And so it's like a baby. A baby is not intending to be baptized, you know, and the baby, I've even seen babies being baptized and they're old enough, they're going, no! And, you know, they're clearly rejecting on one level what's happening, but they're not free moral agents. So their baptism is valid anyway because they're not capable of understanding and putting a barrier between them and God.
Ah.
And so even if you were totally blitzed, I think there's an argument that it would still be valid because you're not a moral agent at that point and you're not capable of putting a barrier between you and God.
Yeah.
So having said that, is this at all a good idea?
Well, I think it depends on the situation.
Well, like, sure. That's a very good point. Yeah. If you're dying and you're blitzed, by all means, go to confession.
Yeah. But the plane's going down.
Yeah.
And absolutely. There's a priest next to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if it's one or two drinks, well, okay. To kind of scale back to the original scenario, if it's one or two drinks and you're buzzed, well, okay, it's not really necessarily a great idea to go into confession that way, lest you forget something that you need to confess, or articulate it the wrong way or something like that. That could be taken care of though if you have a list of what you're going to confess. And by the way, if you have a list, destroy it afterwards. But
stole $1 at work.
Yeah. But if you some people take lists with them into confession. And if you just work your way down the list, even though you're buzzed, you're going to get everything out you needed to say. Also another disadvantage to going in buzzed is you may not appreciate fully on an emotional level what's being done for you. On the other hand, the flip side of that is some people are emotionally uptight and maybe having a drink or two would loosen up your emotions. You might appreciate it more emotionally.
Right.
You might break down and cry over something you did.
Right.
If you did forget something because you were buzzed, well, that's not great, but it would still be valid because you didn't deliberately withhold anything. But when you sober up or come off the buzz and you remember, oh man, I should have confessed that, well, then you would want to confess it next time around.
Jim, thanks very, very much. Let's go to...
Oh, another circumstance that could justify having a drink or two before confession would be if you have an emotional difficulty of confessing certain matter.
Oh, and
you need it to... The same thing, you could take an anti-anxiety drug or something, you know, a pill, to help you loosen up, to be able to get it out. But you want to make sure that you got a ride home or something or take an Uber.
Yeah, take an Uber, Jim. Thanks for the question. It's Internet Open Forum today. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with this name. Jot. I'm going to say Jot.
Could be Jate or Yate.
And one of those asks, why some Protestants take time to accept the Catholic Church, even though the early church is clearly the Catholic Church?
Well, this is similar to the question we did about why don't Jewish people accept Jesus on the basis, non-Christian Jewish people accept Jesus on the basis of Old Testament prophecy. This is why don't Protestants accept Catholicism on the basis of patristic texts. And I think there are several answers here. The first one is, well, many Protestants don't give any authority to patristic texts. They might say, well, okay, so maybe the Church Fathers has had these Catholic ideas. That just shows they went apostate and got corrupt sooner than I thought.
Yeah.
Now, not all Protestants take that attitude. Many Protestants concede a serious hearing to the Church Fathers. And so some of them would say, well, I agree. There are strands of thought in the Church Fathers that are clearly Catholic, but I'm not convinced because there are some other strands too that are not Catholic. And so it's really a question of which sets of traditions you choose to accept. And I don't think the ones that point in the Catholic direction are the ones that I should accept, even though obviously the church grew into the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And there was this sifting out of traditions that led to Catholic viewpoints. The main reason, though, that I think that that most Protestants don't accept the Catholic Church on a patristic basis is because they never read the Church Fathers. They have almost no contact with them. If you go to a Protestant church, you can go for years, and maybe you'll hear an occasional reference to St. Augustine, but people don't consistently, the ordinary people, they're focused on Scripture exclusively, or Scripture plus the tradition, the theologians in their own tradition. They have, ordinary people in the pews have basically no contact with the writings of the Church Fathers, and they're typically not encouraged to read the Church Fathers. They're not discouraged either. It's just something that isn't on the map for them mentally.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the question. We got time to do more here before we have to take a break. It's Internet Open Forum, so we will go to Jordan's question now. And Jordan asked this, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. Why isn't Boethius considered a saint? It seems like he was martyred in his book, The Consolation of Philosophy.
Yeah, so The Consolation of Philosophy is a book that the 5th century author Boethius wrote as he was awaiting execution. And it's considered a classic work of philosophy. In fact, it provides the classic definition of eternity, which is the whole simultaneous possession of unending life. And that became the church's definition that the church uses for eternity, comes right out of the Consolation of Philosophy, which he wrote was kind of like letters from a Birmingham jail, only about philosophy instead of race relations.
Right.
And so Boethius was a very admired figure in in down through church history, but in particular in the Middle Ages. And in terms of why is he not considered a martyr? Well, two things to say. First thing, the reason he's in prison is because the king thought that Boethius had engaged in treason. And in order to properly qualify as a martyr, it's not enough that you be executed or that you're a good guy and that you're executed. It's that you're executed because the person executing you hates the Christian faith and you refuse to give it up or compromise it. And it is not clear that the king hated the Christian faith and that's why he's executing Boethius. In fact, as far as I'm aware, the king was a Christian. And so I haven't looked that up specifically, but I'm pretty sure that's true. And so if someone gets executed on treason charges, even if they're a good guy, and even if they're innocent of the treason charges,
that's not martyrdom.
Yeah. But Boethius is considered a saint. He's in the Roman martyrology. His feast day is October 23rd, but he's a local saint, meaning his feast day is restricted to the Diocese of Pavia in northern Italy, which is where he's specially venerated. But he actually is considered a saint.
All right. Thanks very much for the question, Jordan. Better take a quick break. Be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The World Over with Rima DeRoyo. Coverage as seen through a Catholic lens.
All people of faith and sincerity need to awaken to this and protect this fundamental right of religious liberty.
Expert analysis.
Does revelation judge history or does history judge revelation?
Stories vital to people of faith.
It's part of our faith that comedy and tragedy naturally go hand in hand.
Delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up today. Go to EWTN.com/worldover.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, having a lot of fun taking questions from the internet. Jimmy Akin here as our guest. And more from the internet. Ryan asks this. Since we as Latin Catholics fulfill our obligation to attend Mass on a holy day of obligation, can we fulfill our obligation to attend Mass in an Eastern Catholic church, even if they celebrate a holy day on a different date that's not the same date on the Latin calendar?
Yes. The right of Catholics in the Latin Rite to fulfill their Sunday obligation is, according to the Code of Canon Law, it is fulfilled by attending Mass in any approved Catholic rite. Period. There are no. Now, sometimes people go, well, "What if they're not celebrating this day? Or what if their readings aren't the same?"
Yeah.
Okay, you don't have an obligation to go to a Mass commemorating a particular day or hear a particular set of readings. It is just not there. So if I go to a Chaldean Mass on a Latin holy day of obligation, I have fulfilled my obligation to attend Mass on that day.
Yes.
My obligation is not to hear a particular set of readings
right.
or a sermon about a particular theological thing. It's to go to Mass. And so consequently, the church does not want people stressing about this. And the way the law is written, it is very clear any Catholic Mass in any approved rite will fulfill your Sunday obligation no matter what rite it's in or what readings you're hearing or what the liturgical day is.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate that question. This one comes from...
In fact, that's the whole point of that canon.
Is to let,
because,
you, know.
Yeah. Is to let you know that because... They wouldn't bother saying in any Catholic rite.
Yeah.
It was like, well, if you go to another rite, they're not going to have the same readings because it's not the same rite and their liturgical calendar is different. So the whole point of saying you can fulfill it in any rite means it doesn't matter what the readings are or what the liturgical day is in the rite you're attending.
I wonder sometimes if we Catholics are particularly good at putting obligations on ourselves that are not actually obligations, or if every religion does that. I mean,
everybody does that. That's
so?
A human universal.
Like, you're required to do this. Well, you're not actually, like, we lay a lot on ourselves that's not actually there if you look it up. Rick asks this. Oh, this is interesting. Is it possible to have holy orders by desire? For example, if someone dies while a seminarian, or would it have to be dying on the way to ordination?
So when we talk about receiving the sacraments by desires, what that's really code for is receiving the graces of the sacrament, and in particular, the grace of sanctifying grace that restores the soul to union with God and that grows one in charity and things like that. Baptism of desire, where someone desires to be baptized and they participate in the graces of baptism in an anticipatory way, does not mean that they have all of the graces of baptism. What they have is sanctifying grace, which will put them right with God.
Mm-hmm.
But baptism does other things, like it imprints a mark on the soul and it enables you to receive the other sacraments. Well, if you have baptism of desire, you get the sanctifying grace.
Yeah.
But you don't have the mark on your soul yet.
Oh.
And you do not get to go receive the other sacraments.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, I desire baptism. I ought to be able to take the Eucharist.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't work that way. You get the grace that you need to be right with God. Same thing if someone makes an act of perfect contrition. Well, then that's essentially confession of desire, and you get restored to grace with God. To what extent does this work with other sacraments? Well, you can always, by desire, acquire more grace. mm-hmm. you know, more sanctifying grace. But it's not going to confer on you the other aspects of what the sacraments do, like confirmation. Confirmation also puts a mark on the soul. If you desire God's grace, well, God will share his grace with you, but he's not putting the mark on your soul until you get confirmed.
Yeah.
How about marriage? Okay. Well, if you want sanctifying grace from God, he'll give that to you. But just because you desire to be married to someone, and even if they desire to be married with you,
yeah.
you're not married until you're married.
Yes.
So you can't acquire simply any sacramental benefit by desiring the sacrament. The one you can is sanctifying grace. And maybe in the case of anointing of the sick, if it's God's will, he might heal you too. But that's entirely up to God. In the case of priestly ordination, well, do priests get sanctifying grace? Yeah. Could they get that through ordinary desire? Yeah. Does that give them the ability to confect the Eucharist and put a permanent mark on their soul?
No.
No. So there's not going to be a holy orders of desire in any sense that would allow you to carry out priestly duties. It's not going to put a mark on your soul. It's not going to let you confect the Eucharist or hear confessions and validly absolve people or confirm people or anything like that. But God is happy to share sanctifying grace with you if you want that.
Ryan, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. Rick, actually. That one came from Rick. Ryan was the question before. Sorry about that, Rick. Let's go to a question from David. When Jesus calls on the disciples to be fishers of men, is he referring to baptism as the means of bringing on the new Exodus?
So I wouldn't be at all surprised if people have speculated about that, in particular in ages where the spiritual reading of the text is very common, but there's nothing in the literal sense of the text that would suggest that, because the "I will make you fishers of men" texts in Matthew and Luke are situations where Jesus is encountering not the disciples in general, but four specific disciples: Matthew or Peter, Andrew, James, and John.
Mm-hmm.
And he's inviting them to become fishers of men because they were fishermen. They're on the lake. They're doing their job. They're fishing, or technically, in one case, like they're mending the nets. But they were literally fishermen, and now he is inviting them, just as they catch fish for people to eat. Now he's inviting them to catch fish for God. And so it's the catching of fish that's the key thing, not the putting the fish in water, which is what baptism is. Fish were already in water when they literally caught them. And so in the metaphor of fishing for men, you're taking them from a watery environment to God.
Yeah.
You could always jam baptism in there because it happens to involve water, but it's not what's naturally suggested by the metaphor.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you want to see resonances like that in the spiritual sense of the text, that's fine. I just wouldn't claim it's the literal sense of the text.
All right. Thank you very much for that question, David. This next one comes from Sean. Is Mary's perpetual virginity a doctrine or is it a dogma? If a dogma, was it infallibly defined at a council?
So there's three things we need to talk about here, three categories. The first one is doctrine. Doctrine is anything the church teaches authoritatively, which is from the Latin word doctrina, which just means teaching. Within the category of doctrines, there is a smaller category of doctrines that have been infallibly taught. And oftentimes people confuse this with dogmas. No. Something can be an infallible doctrine without it being a dogma. Dogmas are a smaller set of teachings that are not only infallible, they are infallibly taught to have been divinely revealed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to say it's not just infallible, but it's a dogma, the church has to have said, and it's divinely revealed. Now, in terms of Mary's perpetual virginity, it is a doctrine, obviously, because the church teaches it. It is also an infallible doctrine because it was infallibly defined at the First Lateran Council in the year 649. They've got a canon that says if anybody denies this, let him be anathema, which means ceremonially excommunicated.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean divinely condemned. It means ceremonially excommunicated. The interesting question would be, is it also a dogma? Well, it clearly is divinely revealed that Mary was a perpetual virgin. Scripture and tradition make that clear in various ways. But I don't know if I would be confident asserting that the church at First Lateran has infallibly said it's divinely revealed. Because they didn't use the same language that later councils and popes did when defining a doctrine. So there's a little question in my mind on that, but my bet would still be, yeah, it fully qualifies as a dogma.
Thanks,
but
Sean.
It's certainly an infallible teaching.
Let's see if we can get Joe's question. It's a little bit longer. Joe says, Jimmy, I have a hard time reconciling the idea of you shall know them by their fruits with the idea of scandal. Playing devil's advocate, how can we, as Catholics, contend that we hold the truth while at the same time be riddled with scandal? It would seem that a non-Catholic Christian could be quick to write the whole Catholic Church off by claiming bad fruits, therefore not true.
So, and I made a similar point that you could write off the true faith in, say, Samuel's time in the Old Testament if you looked at the performance of the priests. I mean, Eli and his sons were so bad they ended up dying mm-hmm. as a result of divine judgment. And I could have missed the true faith if I was a pagan, if I used that as a criterion. So that's probably a bad idea. And that suggests we ought to think a little harder about what Jesus was saying when he proposed this test. Was he proposing, Cyril Kellett, host of Catholic Answers Live, that people judge whether Judaism was true or Christianity was true on the basis of the performance of individual teachers?
No, he was not.
Right. So he wouldn't say, oh, well, you should reject Judaism if this priest is bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So if he wasn't saying you should reject a theological system because its priests or officials are bad, then you wouldn't reject Catholicism just because of scandals in the church. So what is he suggesting we reject here when he says you'll know a tree by its fruits? He's not talking about a theological system. Who is he suggesting or what is he suggesting we reject?
I'm a little bit stumped because
how about the teachers, the bad teachers?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what's under discussion when he talks about you'll know a tree by its fruit. The tree stands for a teacher. You have teachers that bear good fruit. You have teachers that bear bad fruit. You want to listen to the teachers that bear good fruit
right.
and not the ones that bear bad fruit because they're more reliable. They're more in sync with God if they're genuinely producing good fruit. But he's not proposing that as a test for doctrine. He's proposing that as a test for other things, like should I give this guy my donations or should I give this guy my attention
right.
or things like that. And if you have someone who's known to be unreliable, then, okay, write that person off. Don't mess with them because they're known to be unreliable.
Thanks, Joe. Real quick before we go, Tom asks this, Jimmy. Did Jesus drink wine or only grape juice?
He drank wine, and we can show that not only because alcoholic wine was required for the Passover ceremony, and not only because alcoholic wine is what wine is. People in this age did not... That's what they drank. We just know that from multiple historical sources. But we can specifically show it in Jesus's case because of the wedding of Cana. At the wedding of Cana, they've been having one of these big Middle Eastern, this is my big fat Middle Eastern wedding. And the party goes on and on and on, and they drink all of the wine. So Jesus makes them some more, and the major domo tastes it and says, oh, this is the good stuff. You've done the opposite of what most people do. Most of the time, they bring out the good stuff, and then when people have lost their taste, they bring out the cheap stuff. But this is the good stuff. So, Cy Kellett, does grape juice make you lose your taste?
It does not.
It does not, because it doesn't have alcohol in it.
Right.
So the good stuff, which dulls your taste, is alcoholic wine. And therefore, the Mater D, or Major Domo, identifies for us the fact that Jesus has just made vats of alcoholic wine to keep this party going.
Thanks, Tom, for that question. Very direct, very concise, very helpful. We get, you know, I think I'm not good with math, but it looks like we have about 1 million more questions to get to. So we'll have to do internet
approximately.
Approximately 1 million. So you'll do this again with us sometime.
Absolutely.
Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. You can find a whole bunch of his books and other things over at shop.catholic.com, and you can enjoy his weekly explorations of secular, historical, scientific, faith mysteries over at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And that about does it for us. Thanks,
Jimmy. Thank you.
We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.